In the world of make-believe, Wakanda, an African ethno-state which has remained free of European colonial interference, looks like this. But I've always been about the real world on this channel, and thought it might be interesting to look at a real-life example of an African ethno-state which has remained free of European colonial interference. That example is Liberia. Like Wakanda, it is an ethno-state, but unlike Wakanda, it is on the West African coast as opposed to the East African coast. It has Sierra Leone to the northwest, Guinea to the north, and Ivory Coast to the east. It is rich in natural resources and has much fertile soil, which could be cultivated into cereals or cash crops. So what do we mean by ethno-state? We mean that there is a specifically racial element written into its constitution. White people, or indeed Asians, are not allowed to become Liberian citizens. It is reserved only for black people. Article 5, Section 13 of the 1847 Constitution states, "The great object of forming these colonies being to provide a home for the dispersed and oppressed children of Africa, and to regenerate and enlighten this benighted continent. None but persons of colour shall be eligible to citizenship in this republic." The phrasing "persons of colour" was changed to "Negroes" or "persons of Negro descent" in a 1955 revision. The country has been independent since 1847 and has no history of European colonialism. As the economist George Dalton put it in 1965, with the partial exception of Ethiopia, Liberia is the only country in Africa which was never the colony of a European power. It has been a sovereign republic since 1847. For those who are impressed by the favourite myth of African political leaders, that before European colonisation, Africa must have enjoyed some sort of golden age because its present economic and social problems are the evil legacy of wicked European colonialism, an examination of Liberia is instructive. In this video, we're going to take a look at its history. The first settlements of former African American slaves in Liberia took place in 1822. Around 20,000 of them migrated from America to these settlements, which had been acquired legally from local tribes. Around 15,000 went there of their own accord, and around 5,000 were sent there after US gunships had apprehended illegal slave ships in the Atlantic. The Republic of Liberia was founded through the efforts of the American Colonization Society, aided and abetted by the government of the United States. The society was formed in 1816 and represented an attempt to establish a civilized Christian state in West Africa by repatriating liberated persons and providing them with the means of settlement, subsistence, and defense. Attempts were made in 1820 and 1821 to settle the coast. And finally, in the latter year, an arrangement was made with the natives and a town started, which was called Monrovia. The original negotiations were handled by two agents of the government and Captain Robert F. Stockton in command of the USS Alligator. From the earliest days of the settlement in 1821-1822 to the present, the Americo-Liberians have acted like Portuguese, British and Afrikaner colonists in other parts of Africa. They maintain an identity distinct from tribal persons in speech, dress, source and level of income, style of life and culture. Indeed, their preference for politics, law and plantations, and in their disdain for commerce, the descendants of the freed slaves are an aristocracy. Like European colonizers in other parts of Africa, the Americo-Liberians subdued the tribes with force and fraud for high-sounding purposes. The large land purchases, paid for with beads, muskets, tobacco, and umbrellas, were negotiated with chiefs to whom the practice of permanent alienation of land was unfamiliar. Americo-Liberian leaders said they had a manifest destiny to bring civilization to the tribal heathen. Slavery was to be suppressed, and the colony was to be a beachhead for Christianity in Africa. From 1821 to 1839, several Americo-Liberian settlements, independent from one another, were established along the coast on the initiative of the American Colonization Society to repatriate free Negroes, and similar organizations set up on its model in several American states. The first move towards consolidation into a central polity, the isolated coastal settlements joining together as a commonwealth, occurred in 1839 in response to tribal hostility. It was imperative that the isolated settlements band together for mutual defense. The Americo-Liberians learned early that the survival of their community depended on cohesion within. They learned also to defeat tribal uprisings with cannon and guns. As late as 1915, the United States government provided the settler community with military advisers and weapons to put down an uprising among the Crew, an energetic people who rebelled again in 1931-32. Eventually, in 1847, the Americo-Liberians united their settlements and declared independence from the USA. Their stated aims were for the country to become a beacon of liberty modeled after the United States, with the Constitution closely following the US Constitution, and the governmental structure also designed along American lines, with a president, a Senate, and a House of Representatives, and a separate judiciary with a Supreme Court. However, in practice, it has never operated at all like the USA in its entire history, as we shall see. Liberia was recognized by Great Britain in 1848. This was important because Britain was the global superpower at this time and a major influence in the region. Incidentally, the USA did not recognize Liberia as a sovereign state until 1862, because the Liberians had restarted the slave trade. One thing to note in this early period of Liberia's history is that the country quickly got itself into financial trouble. They had established a new currency called the Liberian dollar, initially on par with the US dollar, with real minted coins. However, it quickly depreciated and they issued paper money before the currency became next to worthless in the early 1870s, and they adopted the pound sterling on the gold standard. As Lee A. Gardner argues, this was good for the Americo-Liberian elites who had access to foreign trade, but not so much for the tribal natives. By 1869, said elites had established the True Whig Party. Its first president was Edward James Roe. They held power continuously from 1877 to 1980. Even though Liberia was nominally a republic along American lines in theory, in practice it was a one-party state which operated a dual legal system. Americo-Liberians were only 2% of the population and occupied the coastal strip, while native tribal Liberians were restricted to live in the hinterlands. Special taxes and coercive sanctions were imposed on the tribal Liberians. Regulations controlled tribal residence and migration. Tribal Liberians were forced into both private and public labor, although they were paid in order to ensure that the USA did not see it as slavery. Tribal Liberians could not vote. During its first 79 years, it is fair to say that Liberia achieved nothing whatsoever. They built scarcely any infrastructure, they developed no industry, they failed to establish basic modern utilities such as an electricity grid or public sanitation. The next major milestone in Liberian history came in 1926 when this chap, Harvey Firestone, founder of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, showed a rare interest in making an investment. He was granted a 99-year lease for 1 million acres of land to set up rubber plantations. Rubber was not indigenous to Liberia, and Firestone had to establish the operations from scratch. However, the deal came at a cost. Not only did Firestone have a complete monopoly on rights to rubber production in Liberia, but also as part of the deal, he provided the Liberian government a loan of $5 million at 7% interest to clear current debts and to build a harbour, which the company needed to export its shipments of rubber. The loan was given in exchange for complete control over the Liberian government's revenues until it was paid back. The loan kept growing as a portion of Liberian government income until by 1932 it was 100% of revenues. These loans were not fully repaid until 1952. I don't think it is too much of an exaggeration to say that for a period of about 26 years, Liberia was an owned subsidiary of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, and the company remains to this day the nation's largest employer. Although, interestingly, that 99-year lease is up in 2025, and the question of whether or not it will be extended has been a live issue for some time. Anyway, in 1944, Liberia elected this man, William Tubman, pictured here with John F. Kennedy, who became brutally repressive after an assassination attempt in 1955. It was widely believed that the assassination attempt was a false flag ordered by Tubman himself so he could enact emergency powers. He remained president for 27 years until his death in 1971. They didn't bother with all that term limit business in Liberia. Now, even by the 1960s, and even with the huge investments by the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, Liberia was still severely underdeveloped. As Dalton put it, Liberia enjoyed none of the benefits of European colonization, which in some measure were conferred on most other African countries. It received neither the tangible benefits of roads and schools, nor the more important but less tangible benefits of trained administrators and a civil service ethic of efficient and honest performance. Instead, the traditional practices and values of Americo-Liberian society were carried into the post-war period. By the early 1960s, after well over 100 years as a nation, Liberians had set up virtually no infrastructure. The vast majority of the population was illiterate, less than 10% could read or write. 25% of the workforce were recruited involuntarily. That means they had been forced into labour. As Dalton explains, it had two trade unions in 1962, but the president's son was the head of one, and the president's social secretary was the head of the other. Strikes were illegal, and there were no collective bargaining contracts. It had a minimum wage law, 4 cents an hour, but the law did not cover agricultural and domestic workers, who comprised more than 80% of all non-governmental wage workers. By 1960, out of a population of 1.12 million people, only 82,000 had salaried jobs. Of these, 1 in 7, that's 11,600, worked for the government, mostly rewarded for loyalty. Collective punishment, i.e. the whole family was punished, was dispensed to those who opposed the government. Until 1944, the hinterlands had no representation in parliament. By paying a $100 tribute, tribes could send a representative to Congress, but without a vote. After 1944, they introduced universal suffrage, but with heavily, almost comically, rigged elections. The electoral reform was done solely to give the appearance of democracy to the USA and Europe. Nepotism and cronyism were total. This map shows just how many of William Tubman's family were embedded in key positions of influence and power across every facet of life. Liberian society was locked in a caste system, with most of the population, over 95%, in category E here, tribal or uncivilized. Around this time, Tubman enacted an economic policy known as Open Door. This referred to the fact that Liberia was ready for more foreign direct investment following the Firestone model. It was a success, with mainly American investors coming in to set up iron ore and shipping operations, that is, the construction of naval vessels and battleships. This saw an 800% increase in government revenues in 10 years. However, increased effective demand because of higher wages did not induce an increase in domestic enterprise or production, but simply increased imports. Government borrowing increased too, from near zero after the Firestone debt was finally paid off to over $100 million, which in today's money is over $863 million. This might not sound like a lot, but consider that the population of Liberia was only 1 million. Or in other words, for every Liberian citizen, the government owed $100. They didn't borrow this money to build anything tangible, such as infrastructure or public utilities. Either the money went exclusively on government wages. And as you saw, that was mostly the president's own extended family. In terms of the workforce, 65% of the population were in subsistence agriculture. That basically means they were living in the bush in the hinterlands. 30% of them were unskilled labourers, mostly working on rubber farms, earning an average of 75 cents a day. And 5% were the professional class who worked in government or else were absentee landowners or lawyers. Almost all staff positions in rubber or iron ore operations were foreign. The basic structure of the economy looked like this. It was overwhelmingly reliant on the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company, which still enjoyed a monopoly contract for exports, so was the only buyer of rubber from the 2,600 independent Liberian-owned rubber plantations. George Dalton, who had spent some years posted there doing fieldwork as a development economist, concluded his 1965 report on a somewhat despondent note. This is Dalton. Foreign economists who work in countries like Liberia confront a dilemma. If they confine themselves to conventional measurement, economic analysis, and policy prescriptions for development, they are wasting their effort. The governing authorities of Liberia have no intention of developing the national economy and the Liberian people. And the present political and social arrangements offering economic advice to Liberian leaders is futile. What is the point of showing them how to increase tax revenues by $5 million if the revenue would be frittered away on objects and activities that have little, if any, effect on national welfare or development? Economic development is the proper concern of economists, but in Liberia, political and social reform are the most important of all preconditions for development. And so economists are forced into political and social as well as economic analysis. After Trubman died, his longtime deputy William R. Talbot took over. With corruption near total, Samuel Doe staged a violent coup d'etat, executing President Talbot and much of the True Whig Party leadership. Doe was the first native, which is to say indigenous or tribal, leader of Liberia. The Americo-Liberians, a tiny elite that had dominated the country since its foundation in 1847, had finally been toppled. Unfortunately, despite some initial successes, opening the ports for foreign trade with Canada, China, and Europe in the early 1980s, Doe proved to be just as bad as the old Americo-Liberians. Doe was part of the Kran ethnic group, which had its own tribal affiliations. And essentially, all that happened is that the Kran replaced the Americo-Liberians as the new elites. After a failed attempt on his life in 1985, Doe, like Trubman before him in 1955, became brutally repressive, shut down the newspapers, and banned all political activity. His mistreatment of certain ethnic tribal groups caused division and violence. Meanwhile, the renegade international fugitive Charles Taylor, who had been on the run since 1983, emerged leading a guerrilla force called the National Patriotic Front of Liberia, which had been trained in Libya by Colonel Gaddafi, who had taken in Taylor as his protege. Striking from the Ivory Coast, Taylor launched an attack on Liberia in order to overthrow Doe. To make matters more complicated, in the middle of all this, and in scenes reminiscent of Monty Python's Life of Brian, one of Taylor's senior commanders, Prince Johnson, broke off the NPFL to form the INPFL, that is the Independent National Patriotic Front of Liberia. Johnson then captured Monrovia, the Liberian capital, captured Samuel Doe, and then tortured him to death. He is also alleged to have done the same to several Firestone tire and rubber executives. Anyway, this sent the country into chaos, as the conflict fragmented along ethnic and tribal lines in an eight-way battle, which included the Americo-Liberians still vying to get back into power. Johnson was briefly president, but it was decided that the Americo-Liberian academic Amos Sawyer should act as an interim president while there was such conflict between Johnson and Taylor. Now, I want to keep this video reasonably family-friendly, so I will spare you the grisly details of the carnage that followed during the Liberian Civil Wars, during which every act of atrocity and depravity imaginable took place. They must surely rank as some of the most brutal in history. Suffice it to say that Charles Taylor's 1997 presidential campaign slogan, "He killed my ma, he killed my pa, but I will vote for him," says it all. A catalogue of all the terrible things Taylor did in his life would take a whole other video. He was tried in The Hague for war crimes and crimes against humanity in 2012 and sent to a special prison for 50 years. But remarkably, not for his atrocities in Liberia, but for his role in the civil war in neighbouring Sierra Leone, where he was also causing trouble. The judge said he was guilty of some of the most heinous and brutal crimes in recorded history, and you can see a list of them here. Anyway, let's look at the impact of the civil wars on Liberia. What little infrastructure there was had been destroyed. The economy shrunk by 90%. 95% of health facilities had been destroyed. The debt to GDP ratio reached 800%, which means for every dollar the government spent, they owed 8 back. 8% of the population had died, around 250,000 people in total. Cannibalism was widely reported. Many people were living on bushmeat, that's feeding on elephants, chimpanzees, hippopotamuses, and other such wild creatures. And now, in 2020, 83% of the population are living below the poverty line. Only 15% of the population are in legal labour. That means they're part of the official labour statistics. GDP per capita is $297. To put this in perspective, that is almost 20,000 times lower than the GDP per capita of the USA. More than 58% of women have undergone female genital mutilation. More than 20% of children are malnourished. 83% of people are without basic sanitation. 2% of the population are HIV positive, and 90% of food is imported because domestic production is negligible. As I was doing research for this video and considering the depressing history of this country, the thing I found most dispiriting was that in no time in its 173-year history did it even look like anything would get going. The only things remotely approaching good news in Liberian history came from elsewhere. That's the foreign investment, foreign enterprise, rather than coming from the Liberians themselves. This is especially disheartening for someone like me who believes in the power of entrepreneurship and individual private enterprise. But this never flourished at any point in Liberia's history. Now, people will debate the reasons and the factors for why this is, and I will leave that to them. But there it is, the real Wakanda. Now get out.